Welcome to BioCentury This Week, the podcast with BioCentury's editorial team. I'm Jeff Cranmer, one of the executive editors here at BioCentury. And joining me to talk biotech are my colleagues.
Stephen Hansen, Director of Biopharma Intelligence.
Karen Tkach-Tuzman, Director of Biopharma Intelligence.
And Steve Usden, Washington Editor.
On today's podcast, another strong week for biotech financings. We take a look and we introduce our distillery spotlight. First up in the series is an upstream look at Alzheimer's mechanisms, plus the latest on China policy and the Inflation Reduction Act. We'll also sneak in a look at a new obesity strategy by a biotech out of the UK. All right, it was another strong week last week for cash flows into public biotechs. 11 companies, at least 11 companies, together raised more than $3 billion in a series of follow-ons and pipes, with recent catalysts or earnings reports driving most of the action. Here to tell us a little bit about that is Stephen.
Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, you know, heading into the year, you know, I think we were kind of hoping and crossing our fingers that it was going to be a better financing year for biotech than what we'd seen in the past 2 years. And so far, you know, at least through the first 2 months, you know, I think that actually really is kind of playing out. You know, just if I start with the follow-on market, you know, we've had about $6.7 billion raised through the first 2 months of 24, which is about twice what biotechs raised during the same period last year. And it's the most since we've seen since 2021. And, you know, we can all remember that was itself an outlier in many ways. But the averages being raised are higher than any period over the past 7 years. And I went back 7 years just to add a few years that were pre-pandemic to the mix. And that includes the 2020, 2021 years. So, you know, it's been a really good showing for biotech on the follow-on markets early on. And very similar things for other financing mechanisms, notably the pipes, which are, you know, proving to be quite popular so far this year. The largest amount of money we've seen raised over the first 2 months of the year overall for the past 7 years, there was $5.8 billion in public equity, sort of other public equity financing mechanisms. Most of that is through these pipe deals. And, you know, I think the thing that's interesting there is that if you look back in 2019, 2020, these non-follow-on deals were largely small deals where you had companies raising $5, $10, $15 million. Well, that's just really not the case now. You know, I think half of these deals were more than $25 million in these pipes that largely includes most of the big name crossover investors sort of getting involved. So some really interesting deals getting done and lots of companies, I think, finally able to raise the capital that they've sort of been desperately looking for over the past sort of, you know, 24 to 30 months.
And pipes, of course, for the uninitiated, private investment in public equity.
That's right.
Stephen, it's great that they're raising this money, but it's all about the aftermarket performance for some of us anyway. How have they performed?
You're right, Jeff. I mean, it's great to raise the money, but if they do terrible in the aftermarket, you wouldn't have high expectations for this to be able to continue. But thankfully, you know, so far they're doing quite well. And it's kind of similar both for the follow-ons and for the pipes. If you look at the follow-ons for deals that raise more than $50 million, 90% of those deals are up in the aftermarket, up a median of 24%. And it's very similar for pipes. For deals that are more than $50 million, 92% of those are up as of March 1st, also up a median of 24%. So getting that sort of aftermarket performance is really good. It means investors are making money, which means that they're going to be more interested in doing other similar deals. And I think it bodes well for heading into the summer here, oftentimes in June, sort of July, is where we can start to see more deals look to get done as well. Maybe we'll start to see the IPO market start to open up a bit more. I mean, this is kind of when you talk to investors and bankers, you need the follow-ons and you need these sorts of deals to be able to not only get done, but to work well for investors, to really give some momentum to them wanting to participate in what are always more risky deals in IPOs. And so at least this sort of setup bodes well for that.
Excellent. Well, thanks for that, Stephen. Let's change gears. I want to bring in Karen now. Karen, of course, is our Director of Biopharma Intelligence, and she heads up our discovery and preclinical research here at BioCentury. And one of the things she curates is what we call the distillery. and she has been looking over distillery entries from 2023 to suss out trends. So, Karen, what have you been, what have you sussed out?
Well, thank you, Jeff. Again, for the uninitiated, the distillery is where we capture preclinical papers from the academic literature. Every week, we survey about 27 journals looking for papers where there's a near-term potential for therapeutic development. They're showing a disease-modifying effect with either a new target or a new compound. And of course, we're not capturing all of the translational innovations happening out there, but we're capturing what we think of as a cross-section of innovation from around the world. And when we do this, we are looking at each paper on the merits, you know, and we aren't looking necessarily to enrich for one type of innovation over another. But that gives us an opportunity to step back, look at the past year in total, and see of the papers we covered that we put into our distillery, which are available nicely in our distillery dashboard. You can sort and filter them in that way. What are the trends that we're seeing in terms of where new targets are emerging, new mechanisms? What kinds of compounds are we seeing, et cetera? And so that is an analysis that will be coming out this week. And so we'll be dropping a little bit each day, looking at different slices of the innovation pie that caught our attention, and then with an overarching analysis on Friday that ties it together. So to give you a sense of what you'll be looking forward to, today we will be diving into some Alzheimer's disease mechanisms that have been pulled out of the distillery. And so again, these are early preclinical from academic labs. And it was interesting to see that among those papers, the targets and mechanisms we're seeing are focused on neuronal biology. So preventing neuronal death, reducing aggregates in neurons and preserving neuronal function, which is sort of different than some of the focus in terms of what the drugs are available, you know, targeting the amyloid, the beta amyloid species, and the sort of next wave of innovations that are more focused on neuroinflammation, so microglia and all of that. So it was interesting to see how this crop of targets that we'll be illustrating in a nice figure don't necessarily map onto what is active in late stage industry, but is sort of represents a orthogonal or additional wave that could be exploited perhaps in combination. Chatting with our neuro expert Selena, she was saying how the neuro field is kind of divided and that some people think some of the neuron function mechanisms might be more just addressing symptoms versus root cause of disease. And others say, well, that's an important thing to do if you can get at symptoms meaningfully. So it'll be interesting to see how innovations like this, whether they filter up into the world of industry, but this is kind of our on the ground look of what's coming out of the papers of university labs.
And Selena being our executive editor, Selena Koch, she is in Singapore for our third BioCentury Bay Helix East-West Biopharma Summit. If you're not there, you can still sign up to check it out digitally. We have some great stuff. Art Pappas will be there. We'll have Doug Williams there and lots of great panels on building a biotech ecosystem, deal making, financing, and R&D. So you can go to biocenturyeastwest.com.
Karen, the Alzheimer's stuff sounds really interesting. What else do you have coming this week? What other areas are you looking at?
So another sort of diseased focus area, a cluster that kind of emerged from the papers was around diabetes mechanisms. So looking at some targets there. And of course, in some cases, the mechanisms translate beyond diabetes to other metabolic diseases. But there's sort of different mechanisms we're seeing there about promoting insulin secretion by beta islet cells, preserving beta islet cell numbers, and other mechanisms that will be illustrated when the story comes out. And then also taking a different tack, I'm also seeing some clusters of papers around, in this case, not diseases, but specific biological mechanisms that I thought was interesting. So there's a cluster of papers around ubiquitin modulators as targets. So these are things like E3 ligases that add a ubiquitin to a protein and target it for degradation. or deubiquitinases that remove ubiquitin and stabilize the protein, or other proteins that regulate this process by modulating the E3 ligases, for example. And it was interesting to see how, you know, of course, we've been hearing about ubiquitin and E3 ligases from the point of targeted protein degraders, so compounds that seek to engage protein degradation mechanisms against a specific target. But here, these were targets that they're endogenous E3 ligases going about their business, degrading proteins in the cell. And the therapeutic strategies here were about pushing those in one direction or another to promote desired therapeutic effects without necessarily dragging them to a specific target the way targeted degraders do. And then there was also an interesting cluster of papers targeting mitochondrial biology across a range of diseases. So all of that you can look forward to this week.
Excellent. Thanks for that. Karen, we're going to take a quick break right now, and then we'll come back and talk policy with Steve.
For more than 20 years, Bioequity Europe has been where CEOs and investors gather to network, partner, and debate critical issues facing the biotech industry. In 2024, Bioequity heads to San Sebastian, Spain, in Basque Country, May 12 to 14th. Join BioCentury, EBD Group, and Regional Host Committee Chair, ICIOS Capital, in one of the world's culinary capitals. Don't wait, last year's Bioequity conference sold out. Visit bioequityeurope.com for more information.
So, Steve, busy week last week with the IRA, with China policy. Let's start with China policy. President Biden released an executive order related to omics, of all things. Why is this important?
So President Biden signed an executive order on preventing access to Americans' bulk sensitive personal data and United States government-related data by countries of concern. That's the official name of it. It's important because it lays out a deliberative process for developing policies to prevent bulk transfers of genomics and other omics data about U.S. citizens, China, and other so-called countries of concern. But it's really about China. Although the executive order and the pending legislation that we've been talking about for a couple of weeks about China biotech address similar issues, they represent completely different mindsets. So the order explicitly rejects decoupling from China as a policy goal. It states that any steps that limit the activities of Chinese companies in the United States must be assessed to ensure that they do more good than harm. And as I said, it's a deliberative process with a lot of opportunity for public comment and the establishment of procedures to identify harms and risks and address them. I should also say it isn't clear how far the administration is going to go toward implementing the executive order before the end of Biden's term, or what would happen with it if he isn't reelected. On the other hand, the authors of the legislation that's pending in the House and in the Senate believe that the United States is in a cold war with China and that it's worth imposing pain on American companies and on the American economy in order to disengage and decouple with China. That's their ultimate goal. And we've discussed also last week and week before, I think, how the bills that are pending have run into opposition because driving WuXi AppTec and WuXi Biologics and other CDMOs, other Chinese CDMOs out of the United States would really shoot American companies.
So, Steve, we're expecting some more action on this week. What should we look out for?
So what do we expect at the hearings this week? There's going to be two hearings, one in the Senate Homeland Security Committee looking at S-3558, and one in the House, the Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party, looking at the bioeconomy and implicitly looking at the Biosecure Act. There's going to be some opposition to S-3558. Its sponsor, Senator Gary Peters, Democrat, seems to be betting that few senators are going to want to vote against an anti-China bill in an election year. I think the executive order makes it easier for Democrats to stay on the sidelines because they can say, look, Biden's got this covered. Even if the Homeland Security Committee passes the bill, I think it's going to be changed substantially before it could become law, including by reducing the threat to Chinese CDMOs operating in the United States. At the Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party hearing, we might hear from its chair, Representative Mike Gallagher, that he plans to narrow the Biosecure Act in response to the concerns that have been expressed about the impacts of driving Chinese CDMOs out of the U.S. But I think that the most important thing to listen for in the testimony and in the comments from the members is how they define success. What are they aiming at? The committee members, who, to be honest, know very little about the life sciences industry, have in the past defined winning as making China lose. And to me, that doesn't make any sense. It certainly doesn't make any sense in the life sciences. The U.S. can't hold China back. And nor should it want to. Doing so would mean that the U.S. policy is to make 1.5 billion people sicker and poorer. That's not something the United States should be about. The U.S. can, however, I think, win by retaining its competitive edge. That's going to be the thing to listen for. Are there ideas that are proposed at the hearing, and does the committee take them seriously for advancing American life science industry rather than just trying to throw sand in the gears of China?
So the CDMOs, obviously the two that have been hit the hardest by all of this, WuXi AppTec and WuXi Biologics, lost billions in market cap as this began to play out. And just looking today, both finished up about 10%. So we'll see how this plays out. But I want to also ask you about the IRA. I know that there was a ruling that came down late last week in the AstraZeneca case, and we also have a big case coming up later this week. Do you want to quickly just tell us what happened there?
Yeah, so quickly, AstraZeneca, the judge rejected everything that they said in the lawsuit. The interesting thing about the AstraZeneca lawsuit is a little bit different from some of the other suits, because in addition to claiming that the IRA violated parts of the U.S. Constitution, AstraZeneca also raised, in their primary contentions were that the law and CMS's implementation of the law, I should say, violate the Administrative Procedures Act. The judge ruled against them and threw it out. So this brings it up for people who are counting as the third lawsuit that biopharma companies or the industry at large has lost. And as I wrote last week, unlike baseball, industry isn't limited to three strikes. There's going to be more. This week, a district court in New Jersey is going to hear arguments from four companies, Bristol-Myers Squibb, J&J, Novartis, and Novo Nordisk, in a massive oral argument where they're all going to present their cases. Most of them are constitutional cases, constitutional arguments. There's some administrative arguments. I'm going to be there, so we'll have something to talk about next week. Hopefully, we'll get some sense from the judge of whether he's sympathetic to any of the arguments.
All right. And for those of you following Steve's work covering biotech policy in Washington over the past three decades, you will note that this is the first time he's ever used a sports reference in his stories. I now challenge him to move on to rock and roll and movies.
I was hoping that he might just incorporate a different sports analogy into each of his stories going forward.
That could be quite good. And of course, this hearing is taking place in the great state of New Jersey, in the town of Trenton. And as we all know, Trenton makes the world
America's. Oh, is it the world takes or America?
The world takes, actually. Trenton's really
global.
It has a vision.
Before we sign off, I want to mention a couple of other things real briefly. Today is the first day that John Crowley is on the job as president and CEO of Bio. So that's going to be very, very interesting to see where he takes that organization. And it looks like we've got a budget deal for the FDA for the year that's already started. Bottom line on that, flat funding for the FDA, basically, which is slightly bad news for the agency because they have a mandatory salary increase that they're going to have to cover. So it's essentially a reduction in their funding. The bill includes a directive to repurpose $50 million for various purposes, including for ALS, which I think is also mixed news. It's good news for ALS patients, but in my opinion, it's bad policy. You know, ALS patients are going to benefit from more attention from FDA. There are patients with many, many other diseases who also need help from regulators, and singling out one disease isn't a good way to make policy.
So you think it should just be broader?
It should be broader, or there should be some kind of purpose to it, some kind of strategic vision for what Congress is telling FDA to do. Just picking out one disease and saying, you know, do more here. Like I said, certainly don't want to take anything away from ALS patients, but there are a lot of other patients with a lot of other diseases who would benefit from more attention from the FDA and a more coherent policy from Congress.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Steve. And you can follow Steve's coverage of the anti-China bills, the IRA, on biocentury.com. Quickly before we go, obesity is all the rage. Steven, I hear that you've been on this taco diet, and I'm very curious to hear about this because I know you've lost a not unsubstantial amount of weight, at least according to your posts. But you've also been following the obesity space for us, and you had a chat with a company that's trying to stand out from the Novos and Eli Lillys of the world, Closed Loop. What did you learn?
Well, where do you want me to start first, with the tacos or with the...
Definitely the tacos. Definitely.
Okay. So I was trying to be a little provocative in my post there. It's really just, I've been having lots of taco salads for my lunch, which are very low carb. And then, yes, lots of fish and chicken and vegetables in the dinner. But yeah, I've dropped about 17 pounds now. So in the past month. So, you know, trying to hang in there. So that was the reference there. As for Closed Loop, you know, I think that Lilly and Novo are kind of leading the pack on the injectable side there. But, you know, I think there's a lot of interest still in what's going to happen with the oral therapies coming, of which the vast majority of those are single sort of monotherapy targets going after GLP-1. And I think one of the challenges there is going to be, how do you differentiate? Because chances are efficacy is, you know, I think you would probably expect it to be largely similar across the board, across these different oral therapies. And so obviously safety is one area where you could try to differentiate, but the side effects are largely driven by the on-target mechanism. So it's going to be hard to see how you could necessarily really improve upon the GI related side effects there. And so I just found it really interesting that one, you know, potential opportunity for trying to differentiate here is what Closed Loop is hoping to offer, which is essentially they're a tech bio company that has a PK/PD real-time monitoring kind of platform that you could incorporate into a development program where you could essentially personalize the dosing regimen for each individual patient, with the idea being that you could potentially, with the idea being that you could improve the tolerability of the program and then potentially even improve the efficacy slightly there. They proved this in a proof of concept study with a generic hypertensive drug, and now they're looking to apply it to obesity. And I just think it's a really interesting idea that you could take something and apply sort of a precision medicine approach, but without having to rely on a biomarker and a pared down sort of target patient population, you know, something that would really bring a personalized therapy for patients. I think payers would like and would really differentiate itself from a player out there who maybe only has one or two doses available on the market.
So you mentioned orals. Is this something that's going to be primarily used in conjunction with small molecule oral drugs, or would it also be relevant for injectables?
I mean, it's relevant across all of the potential therapies, but I think just from a logistics perspective, the idea is that you have a larger range of doses available for patients at smaller increments so that they can essentially do more personalized titration of their dosing. And so to me, it seems like that would be more logistically feasible with a small molecule than it would be with a peptide, where we know that Novo and Lilly already have some sort of supply chain issues in terms of generating just enough API to meet their needs. And so I think if you were to ask a company working with a peptide to generate an even wider range of doses, I think that would put even more strain, right, on their manufacturing.
Well, I guess it would depend on the delivery devices. But it seems to me that the main differentiation that's needed right now is not necessarily on safety and efficacy, it's on pricing. And there's an enormous amount of concern about the impact on the healthcare system of the pricing of the injectable obesity drugs. And if you had orals that could come in at lower cost, and if you had something like you're talking about that allows people to titrate dosing, and again, to do that in a way that lowered costs, that would have an enormous differentiating factor. That would be an enormous sure. differentiating factor.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, sort of beyond what Closed Loop is doing, I think, in a sense. But I mean, that is where I think a lot of the conversation is going now, is that will there be, once orals come on market, is that going to be the maintenance regimen that people could go on to an injectable for a year, get their weight down, and then you look at an oral therapy as being what you use to keep that weight down? And as you say, hopefully those would come in with a lower price point and potentially a little less pressure on healthcare systems.
Well, thanks for that, Stephen. And thanks for tuning in. As always, Kendall Square Orchestra has provided the music for BioCentury this week.